Mark parked the Rolls in Peter Boorter's gravel driveway of the big new house on the outskirts of town. The house was dark and silent, but to Mark's heavy knocking on the carved teak front door, a dog began to bark in the house somewhere, and at last a light bloomed in an upstairs window, and the sash slid up with a squeal. "Who is it? What do you want?" Peter's voice was querulous and fuddled with sleep. "It's Mark!" he shouted up at the window. "You've got to come with me now. My God, Mark, it's after 11 o'clock. Can't it wait until morning? General Courtney wants to see you, now!" The name had its effect. There was a mumble of voices within the bedroom, Marion's sister protesting sleepily, and then Peter called down again. "All right, give me a minute to dress, Mark." As he waited in the driver's seat of the Rolls, with the rain slashing down on the roof and rippling in wavering lines down across the windshield, Mark pondered briefly why he had chosen Peter Boorter. It was not only that he knew exactly where to find him so late at night. He realized that he wanted Peter to be there when they tore down his idol. He wanted to rub his nose in it when they proved Dirk Courtney a thief and a murderer. He wanted that satisfaction, and he smiled bleakly, without humour, in the darkened Rolls. "I deserve at least that," he whispered to himself, and the front door of the house opened. Peter hurried out, ducking his head against the slanting rain. "What is it?" he demanded through the window of the Rolls. "It had better be important, getting me out at a time like this." "It's important enough," Mark told him, and started the engine. "Come on, get in." "I'll follow you in my Packard," Peter told him, and ran to the garage. Peter Boorter sat at General Courtney's big desk. Hurriedly dressed, he was without a necktie, and his small, prosperous paunch bulged the white shirt, pulling it free of his trousers' waistband. His sandy hair was thinning and ruffled, so that pink scalp showed through as he bowed over the foolscap sheet of paper. He wrote swiftly, a neat, regular script, his features betraying each new shock at the words he was transcribing, his cheeks pale and his mouth set and thin. Every few minutes he would pause incredulously and stare at Hobday across the room, breathing heavily at some new and terrible admission. "Have you got that?" the general demanded, and Peter nodded jerkily and began to write again. The others listened intently. The general slumped in his chair by the fire. His eyes were closed as though he slept, but the questions he rapped out every few minutes were bright and penetrating as a rapier blade. Mark stood behind his chair, quiet and intent, his face expressionless, although his anger and his hatred cramped in his guts. Hobday sat forward on the sofa, and his voice was a muffled drone in his thick North Country accent, muted in contrast to the terrible words he spoke. It was not only the killing of John Anders. There was more, much more. Forgery of state documents, bribery of high officials, direct abuse of public office. And Mark started and leaned forward with shock as Hobday recounted how he had tried on two occasions, following Dirk Courtney's orders, to kill him. Mark had not realized nor recognized him, but now Hobday's stocky shape tied in his memory with the shadowy, faceless hunter in the night on the escarpment, and with the other figure seen through the rain and the fever mists. Hobday did not look up as he told it, and Mark had no questions to ask. It was as though once Hobday had started, he must purge himself of all this filth, as though he were now deriving some perverse satisfaction from the horror his words struck into his audience. They listened, appalled by the magnitude of it all. Every few minutes Ruth exclaimed involuntarily, and Sean would open his eyes briefly to stare at her, before closing them again and covering them with one hand. At last Hobday came to the murder of John Anders, and each detail was exactly as Pungushi had described it. Mark felt sickened and wretched as he listened, but he asked only one question. "Why did you let him die so slowly? Why didn't you finish him?" "It had to look like an accident." Hobday did not look up. "One bullet only. A man does not shoot himself twice by accident. I had to let him die in his own time." There was no breadth nor horizon to Mark's anger, and this time Ruth Courtney caught her breath with a sound like a sob. Again Sean Courtney opened his eyes. "Are you right, my dear?" She nodded silently, and Sean turned back to Hobday. "Go on," he said. At the end, Peter Bortus read the statement back, his voice quivering and fading at the more horrendous passages, so that Sean had to gruff at him fiercely, "Speak up, man!" He had made two fair copies, and Hobday signed each page with an illiterate scrawl, and then each of them signed below him, and Sean pressed his wax seal of office onto the final page of each copy. "All right," he said, as he carried the top document to the iron safe built into the wall behind his desk. "I want you to keep and file the other copy," he said to Peter. "Thank you for your help, Mr. Bortus." He locked the safe and turned back into the room. "Mark, will you telephone Dr. Aitchison now, please? We've got to take care of our witness, I suppose. Though for my money, I'd just as soon see him suffer." When Dr. Aitchison arrived at Lion Cop, it was almost 2 in the morning, and Ruth Courtney took him up to the guest room where Hobday lay. Neither Sean Courtney nor Mark went up. They stayed in the study, sitting quietly together across the fire, which a servant had built. Against the windows, the wind bumped and the rain spattered. Sean was drinking whiskey, and Mark had filled his glass twice for him in the last hour. He was slumped down in his favourite chair now, tired and old, and bowed with grief, holding the glass with both hands.
"If I had the courage, I would take the rifle to him myself, like a rabid dog. But he is still my son. No matter how often I deny it, he is still of my blood, of my loins."
Mark was silent, and Ruth came into the room. "Dr. Aitchison is setting that man's arm," she said. "He'll be another hour, but I think you should come up to bed now, my dear." She crossed to Sean's chair and laid a gentle hand on his shoulder. "We have all had more than enough for one day." The telephone rang on the desk, a tinny, irritant sound that startled them all. They stared at it for full 5 seconds until it rang again demandingly, and Ruth crossed to it and lifted the earpiece.
"Mrs. Ruth Courtney?"
she said softly, almost fearfully.
"Mrs. Courtney, are you the mother of Mrs. Storm Hunt?"
"Yes, that is correct."
"I'm afraid we have very bad news. This is the superintendent of Addington Hospital in Durban. Your daughter has been involved in a motor accident. The rain and the mud, I'm afraid. Her son, your grandchild, has been killed outright. Thankfully, he suffered no pain. But your daughter is in a critical condition. Can you come to her as soon as possible? We don't know if she'll last the night, I'm afraid."
The telephone dropped from Ruth's hand, and she swayed on her feet, the colour flying from her face, leaving it frosted with icy white. "Oh, God," she whispered, and she started to fall. Her legs collapsed, and she crumpled forward. Mark caught her before she hit the floor and lowered her onto the sofa. Sean crossed to the dangling earpiece and lifted it.
"This is General Courtney," he barked angrily. "What is it?"
Mark took the big rolls down the long, slanting right-hand turn towards the bridge, very fast. The woman he loved, the mother of his dead child, was dying, and Mark's heart was breaking. The road was deep with chocolate mud, and other vehicles had rutted it deeply, churning the mud to a thick, ugly porridge. The rolls flared and kicked in the ruts, but Mark fought the wheel grimly. The bridge over the Bebouwenstroom was 500 yards ahead of them, still invisible in the endless driving rain. The headlights faded 50 feet ahead, overwhelmed by the flights of white raindrops, thick as javelins. In the rear seat, Ruth Courtney sat quietly, staring ahead with eyes that did not see. The collar of her fur coat was pulled up around her ears, so she looked small and frail as a child. General Sean Courtney sat beside Mark, and he was talking quietly as though to himself.
"I've left it too late. I've been a stubborn old fool. I wanted too much from her. I wanted her to be better than human. And I was too harsh on her when she did not meet the standards I set for her. I should have gone to her long ago. And now perhaps it is too late."
"It's not too late," Mark denied. "She will live. She must live."
"It's too late for my grandson," whispered Sean. "I never saw him. And only now I realize how much I wanted to."
At the mention of Baby John, Mark felt the sickening jolt of despair in his stomach again, and he wanted to shout, "He was my son, my firstborn!" But beside him, Sean was talking again.
"I've been a spiteful and unforgiving old man. God have mercy on me, but I even cut my own daughter out of my will. I disowned her, and now I hate myself for that. If only we can reach her, if only I can talk to her once more, please God grant me that."
Ahead of them, the steel guardrails of the bridge loomed out of the torrential darkness, and lightning bounced off the belly of the clouds. For an instant, Mark saw the spidery steel tracery of the railway bridge spanning the chasm 200 yards downstream. Under it, the rocky sides of the gorge dropped almost sheer, 150 feet, to the swollen, racing brown floodwaters of the Baboonstroom. Mark touched the brakes, and then double-declutched the gears, bringing the rolls under tighter control as he lined up for the entrance to the road bridge. Suddenly, dazzling light flared from the darkness on the right-hand side of the road, and Mark threw up one hand to protect his eyes. Out of the darkness rushed a great dark shape, with two blazing headlights glaring like malevolent eyes as it came. With sudden clarity of mind, Mark realized that the Rolls was trapped helplessly on the approach ramp to the bridge, and that on his left hand only a frail railing of iron pipes screened them from the drop, and that the monstrous vehicle racing down from the right would come into a collision, which would hurl the Rolls through the railing as though it were a child's toy. "Hold on," he screamed, and swung the wheel to meet the roaring, towering monster of steel, and the blinding white light cut into his eyes. Peter Bortus pulled off the road into the pine trees and switched off the engine of the Packard. In the silence, he could hear the pine branches thrashing restlessly on the wind, and the dislodged raindrops tapped on the roof. He lit a cigarette, and the match danced in his cupped hands. He inhaled deeply, waiting for the calming effect of the tobacco smoke, and he stared ahead up the straight roadway that led to Great Longwood, the homestead of Dirk Courtney. He sensed that the decision he must now make was the most vital of his entire life. Whichever way he decided, his life was already changed forever. When Dirk Courtney fell, he would bring down all those close to him, even the innocent, as he was innocent. The scandal and the guilt would sully him, and he had worked so hard for it. The prestige, the blooming career, and all the sweets that he was just now starting to enjoy, all of it would be gone, and he would have to begin again, perhaps in another town, another land, to begin again right at the very bottom. The thought appalled him. He had become used to being a man of substance and importance. He did not know if he could face a new beginning. On the other hand, if Dirk Courtney did not come down, if he was saved from death and disaster, just how grateful would he be to the man who worked his salvation? He knew the extent of Dirk Courtney's present fortune and power, and it was conceivable that some of that, perhaps a large slice of that, might come to him, to Peter Bortus, the man who had saved Dirk Courtney and yet still retained the instrument of his destruction. It was one of those moments of destiny, Peter realized, that came only occasionally to a chosen few. On one hand, dishonor and obscurity, on the other, power and riches, tens of thousands, perhaps even millions. He started the engine of the Packard, and the rear wheels spun in the slimy mud, and then he swerved back onto the driveway and put the big machine to the hill. Dirk Courtney sat on the corner of his desk, one foot swinging idly. He wore a dressing gown of patterned silk, and the lustrous material caught the lamplight as he moved. There was a white silk scarf at his throat, and his eyes were clear and alert in the handsome tanned face, as though he had not just risen from deep sleep. He spun the dueling pistol on his forefinger as he listened intently. Peter Bortus sat nervously on the edge of the chair, and though there was a fire in the grate that Dirk had poked and fed to a fierce blaze, still he shivered every few moments and rubbed his hands together. The cold was in his soul, he realized, and his voice rose a little as he gabbled on.